You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
Philip Flugel is no longer bored.
And welcome to episode 195 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Carlo from The Movie Loot to discuss a 1977 film that tried to capitalize on the success of The Omen, starring Kirk Douglas, Simon Ward, and Agostino Belli, directed by Alberto DiMartino. It's Holocaust 2000. But first...
Like all too many of his contemporaries, Tom is experimenting with something he knows little about.
The Forgotten Filmcast.
It's intermission time, folks, so hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right over to our refreshment center for the most extravagant array of refreshment goodies ever assembled under one roof. Enjoy breathtaking, mouth-watering goodies, everything from a snack to a delicious full meal. At our refreshment center, you'll find a large variety of goodies to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, or your sweet tooth. So hurry, hurry, hurry. Visit our refreshment center now. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're happy to announce that we've installed Burns-O-Matic in-car heaters for your comfort and pleasure. When you receive your heater, you'll find it very easy to place in your car. Just roll down your front window and rest the heater's bracket on the window with the cylinder on the outside of the car. Roll up your window securely as far as it will go to hold the heater firmly in position. For maximum results, tilt the face of the heater towards the windshield and sit back and enjoy the show in healthful comfort. With these modern, safe, efficient in-car heaters, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round. If you have any further questions about your Burns-O-Matic in-car heater, please contact one of our theater attendants. And remember, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round, regardless of the weather.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Exciting, morbid, perverse, ambiguous, enigmatic, more fascinating than ever. Barbara Steele, in an original and passionate interpretation
of the double role of Muriel and Jenny. Jenny, tender, fragile, romantic. Muriel, perfidious, dangerous, sensual. Two beings bound by a single fate and a single sinister secret. Two contrasting individuals, two opposite and distinct personalities. One woman with two faces, or two women with the same face but profoundly different. A fearful doubt, a sinister enigma which becomes an obsessive nightmare in the night of the doom. The story of a guilty and frenzied passion which lives beyond the borders of death. Victim of the sorcery of a merciless and diabolical sadist.
I'll stay with you with my body and my senses until someone comes and destroys my heart.
Now that damned voice will be silent forever, and then we'll be rid of you once and for all!
No, Stephen, I can't stand it!
In the blood-curdling atmosphere of a thrilling drama in which the forces of evil unleash their sorcery and open the gates of the unknown, reality and nightmare merge, sweeping the possessed lovers into the night of the doom.
About last night, it wasn't just an hallucination. It was something unreal and mysterious. And when I was in bed, I knew I was with you when I heard the heartbeats. I was awake. And also when you told...
I know, my dear. You told me. But it can't have been anything but delirium in your mind.
Your wife is not mad. But she runs the risk of becoming so if she continues to live here in this castle.
Is it perhaps the eye of a sick mind which calls up visions that trespass upon the other world? Or are they the fears, the boundless hatred and terror of a monstrous reality that drag a human being to the edge of madness? The Night of the Doom. A human drama that goes beyond human life. The Night of the Doom. A film that will take your breath away, that will hold you spellbound, that you will never forget. Produced by Cinematografica Amici and directed by Alan Grunwald. Soon on this screen.
And now, on with the show.
Just like the name, the fate of the Antichrist will be identical, but the opposite of Jesus. Like in a mirror. He will have 21 apostles instead of 12. His message, too, will be heard by the multitudes, but it will lead to destruction rather than salvation.
Really?
And do your prophecies give the exact date of this catastrophe?
Many of them announce the birth of the Antichrist in the second half of this century.
Then he may be among us now.
Yes, or he'll be born soon.
Do you really believe in all this?
Certainly. Otherwise, my faith would have no meaning.
The only sure proof of faith I see around here are Cuban cigars and the best brandy.
You're right. Lately, I've read the stock market reports too much. And my prayer books too little. Maybe through you, the Lord has sent me a sign. Let me show you something. Our destiny is written here, in the words of the Apocalypse, in the obscure language of symbols. See. Here the Antichrist is pictured in the guise of a lamb. But it has two horns, symbol of betrayal. The Antichrist will unleash the dragon that will destroy mankind. And it will reign for 42 months. In other words, 1,263 days. Been drawn with the same hand.
5,000 miles apart? And 10 centuries later?
Incredible.
Okay, our movie this time is Holocaust 2000 from 1977. And joining me to discuss this film is Carlo from the Movie Loot. Carlo, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to this discussion.
It's going to be interesting, for sure. This is a wild little film we're going to be talking about here. It's great to have you on. Always like having new folks on the podcast. I discovered your show fairly recently and thought, I got to get this guy on the show. So this will be fun. But why don't you take a moment here, tell everybody a bit about yourself and what you do over there on the Movie Loot.
Well, like I said, my name is Carlo, and I've been hosting the Movie Loot for a little over 3 years. I usually say that I'm a cinephile by heart and a computer techie by necessity. But, you know, my real passion is movies. That's because that's why I host a movie podcast and not a computer podcast. We started a bit before the pandemic hit, and our goal is to, this is the official pitch, our goal is to share the best, greatest, most entertaining and or weirdest film that you could find, from the critically acclaimed to the incredibly schlocky, from the US, Europe, Asia, Africa, from the wildly popular to the ridiculously obscure. I guarantee that in every episode you will walk away with at least one worthy film recommendation from our loot, if not more.
Well, awesome. Awesome. I got to say, I love the concept of your show because it addresses something that I've talked about many times on this show, where I have said that the hardest part of my day every day is once I'm finished a long day of work, I've had my dinner, I'm settling in for the evening, and I have to sit down and figure out, what am I going to watch tonight?
Yeah.
And there are so many possibilities. I mean, you know, I've got a ton of DVDs I haven't watched yet. I've got all these different things on all the different streaming services. And it is so hard every night to figure out what I'm going to watch. And I get the impression that maybe you've somehow experienced that same problem, because you've come up with this system now to kind of dictate what you're going to decide to watch, at least some of the time.
Yeah, that was more or less the reasoning, or the initial reasoning for the podcast. And I usually found myself in that same situation, trying to choose what to watch. And there were times, I know that most people would identify with that, with spending like 30, 40, 1 hour trying to choose, or browsing all the services, trying to choose what to watch. So I took an initiative from an online friend who used to make like, she used to choose themes for every month. And this month I'm going to watch films, sports films, or this month I'm going to watch films about this topic or that topic. And I started doing something to that effect. But I found it a bit too restrictive, and sometimes I wasn't in the mood to watch a sports film. So I decided to switch it to this, and it started like a random set of criteria, and to try to guide me in what to watch. But then I adjusted it and tried to choose stuff that was pertinent to each month. For example, if it's January, well, films that have the number one in its title. If it's August, like I'm starting now, a film from, for example, one of the categories I have for this month is a film from William Friedkin, because he was born in August. Also, I chose it because we all know that freaking sadly passed away recently. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to watch something from him. I try to find like weird holiday observances. For example, last year, I didn't put it this year, but last year I found out that there was like a holiday of the rock, paper, scissors day, something like that. And I said, okay, so I'm going to watch a film that has the word rock, paper, or scissors, either one. And it's great because it pushes me sometimes, and it first guides me into what to watch, but it also pushes me into to watch things that I might not find other way. And it's been great to discover obscure hidden films that I wouldn't watch any other way. It's a great tool for that.
I got the impression that you were looking at different holidays and such, because I've listened to a lot of episodes, been binging them a bit lately, and noticed that a lot of times you reference obscure holidays happening throughout the month. I grew up in the city, or not the city, but in the Chicagoland area. When I hear you doing that on the show, it always makes me think about the obscure holiday that we celebrated in the Chicago area, Casimir Pulaski Day, which we used to always get off of school. And I thought, I don't know that there's a film out there that would address Casimir Pulaski Day in any way. But I mean, I suppose it's possible. There's, you know, millions of films out there. But
yeah,
maybe that one will be a challenge for you one day.
I'm sure that somebody has a Letterboxd list of films. How about that?
Yes. I heard that episode where you were going to look at a Friedkin film coming up here this month. Very appropriate. I heard that you were kind of leaning towards Sorcerer. And as I was listening to that, I was going, well, you're in for a treat, because I watched that last year. And it was one of those movies where I went, where have you been all my life? I should have watched you 20 years ago.
That film comes highly recommended, but I'm a bit of a completist, and I hadn't seen Wages of Fear. And since I know that Sorcerer, even though they're totally different films and I could have watched either one, but I'm a bit of a pretty much completist A person. And I said, I want to watch the first one, the original version first. And I watched Wages of Fear last year, and I really loved it. So now I'm ready for Sorcerer. I'm open for any other recommendation from Friedkin. I've seen a lot, but I'm open for any other suggestions. But Sorcerer comes highly recommended by a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things, too, that I'm always impressed about what you pick for your loot each month is you definitely go to some corners of the globe that seem to me like they would be very difficult to find some films from. And I've wondered, has there ever been a time where, like, you pick, you know, I'm going to watch a film from this country and you just can't find anything where you are?
Well, it's interesting because I do my research, and when I make my list of categories, I try to research first to make sure that there's a film industry or there's something to watch from whatever country I'm putting on the pool. So I do that beforehand, so not to push myself into a corner. But there's been some interesting situations. For example, in January, we had a film from Sudan. We had to watch a film from Sudan. And the film that I ended up watching, I found a 1970s film. And I think it was one of the first films from Sudan, from their authentic film industry, because mm-hmm. they were first colonized. But once they gained their independence, I think it was one of their first films. But the weird thing is that it had like white subtitles, but most of the film takes place in a desert in the day, so the subtitles are lost in the sand and the sky. So I pretty much didn't understand anything that was going on. But I remember what the great master Alfred Hitchcock said, that a good film, you can understand what's going on even if you turn the volume down. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I'm not saying that the film was good, but I could follow what was going on if you could more or less see the actions of the people. And I thought it was at least an interesting experience.
Very good. Very good. Well, you're a courageous man. I admire you for that. So, well, let's get on to this movie that we have today, which you may have to be courageous for as well. But I guess we'll see. This is Holocaust 2000 from 1977. It's actually a film that goes by several different titles. Kind of decided we're going to refer to it as Holocaust 2000 since that's what's listed on Letterboxd. That's the title that popped up on Tubi, which is where I watched it. Some of the other titles out there, it's also known as The Chosen, which I think there was a DVD release from Shout Factory a few years back, and they used that title. As a matter of fact, the version on Tubi, even though it's listed there as Holocaust 2000, when you watch the movie and the title screen shows up, it says The Chosen, so even Tubi's confused on this. It's also known as Reign of Fire, Reign spelled R-A-I-N. It's not like the Christian Bale dragon movie. That's different. But it's directed by Albert DiMartino, an Italian director with a lot of credits. In fact, he pretty much hit just about every major genre that Italy is known for. He did some spaghetti westerns, he did peplums, he did police movies, and of course, some giallos. And I'm sure we'll get into it as we go here, but this film certainly has a lot to do with that giallo genre. Among the films in his filmography, we've got stuff like Shadows in an Empty Room, Django Shoot First, and The Puma Man, which, of course, many people know because it was featured on an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000. But probably the most famous film on his filmography is 1974's The Antichrist, which is one of the first films to try and copy the success of The Exorcist. Of course, there's many quote-unquote Exorcist ripoffs, but this one coming just a year after that film. And it's interesting just to keep that in mind because this film is often thought of in terms of another satanic panic film of the 70s, The Omen. It has a lot in common with The Omen. I'm sure we'll talk about that as we go here as well. But this film, it concerns a wealthy businessman named Robert Kane, played by Kirk Douglas, and his company is about to build a big nuclear power plant in an unnamed Middle Eastern country. Now, of course, there are some folks who are down for this, and there's others that are against it. In fact, it seems like everywhere Kane goes, he's confronted with throngs of protesters. They're all shouting things at him like, "What do our kids want to be when they grow up? Alive!" You know, big slogans like that. But, you know, it's a little bit of a complicated situation with this whole power plant thing, because it's going to be built on land that is just adjacent to this ancient cave that may have religious significance. In fact, carved inside are the letters I-E-S-V-S, or Jesus in Latin, okay? Now, Kane has an adult son. His name is Angel. He's played by Simon Ward. And he's all in on the project. He works for his dad's company, helping him out. However, Kane's wife, who is actually the primary stockholder of the company, she has reservations. And she actually decides that she's going to pull the plug on the project. And, of course, Kane is not too thrilled with that. But this decision doesn't last long because a protester busts into a dinner party that the couple is having and tries to kill Kane, but he actually ends up killing the wife instead. So her plan is to shut things down. That comes to an end. So the project is back on again. That is until a newly elected government leader threatens to take it down. But then he ends up getting eliminated because he's showing up at the airport and the top of his head gets lobbed off by a helicopter blade in dramatic fashion. So then the project is on again. So needless to say, there are strange things happening all around Kane. Plus, he starts to have weird visions where he's like running around naked and he sees a seven-headed dragon popping out of the water. Stuff out of the Book of Revelation. So it starts to become clear that the power plant with its seven large towers is actually this dragon, and that the unborn infant that Kane's new wife is carrying may be the Antichrist. So now Kane needs to figure out how to stop the end of the world. Now, this is a film that was released by American International Pictures. It was an Italian production, but here in the U.S., released by AIP, which, of course, is a studio that comes up a lot on our show here a few weeks ago. In fact, we talked about Panic in Year Zero, which was an AIP film. And AIP, just, you know, known for lots of great sci-fi films, beach party movies, biker films, all throughout the 50s and 60s. But here we are in the late 70s, and this is actually getting close to the end of the studio. AIP was going to release its last movie just a few years after this in 1980. So, like I said, it is clearly inspired by The Omen. I'm sure we'll get into that more, but I'm going to let Carlo start us out here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Holocaust 2000.
Well, the first thing is that I don't think I had even heard of the film until you mentioned it, which is it's really weird because I'm a huge fan of The Omen and The Exorcist. So this kind of film has always been on my radar. So I don't know why I really hadn't heard, or if I had heard about it, I had forgotten about it.
I'll be honest, too. I did not ever hear about this movie until just a few weeks ago myself. I saw it pop up, I think, on Tubi, and I was like, I don't know that movie, so it's going on the list. So anyway, please continue.
One of the things that caught my attention, the premise alone, it sounds really interesting. So I thought, you know, this sounds pretty weird and interesting. But Kirk Douglas, I'm a fan of Kirk Douglas. He's an actor that I really hadn't seen much of until a couple of years ago when I started to discover his early work, his first films. Out of the Past is probably my favorite film noir. He's a supporting character there, and he's great. Ace in the Hole is great. It's great. The Bad.
Tremendous, yeah.
Paths of Glory is one of my favorite war films, and I'm a huge fan of Stanley Kubrick. He's my favorite director. So that was one of the main drives to choose this for the show. And it's a really weird film, like you said, borrowing a lot from The Omen, and there are so many things going on. I think, you know, there's this borrowing of Omen. There's, you brought up the connections to Giallo, which the film really has that vibe. I don't think it's a full on Giallo, but I thought it was interesting. It was certainly an interesting watch. I don't think it was completely successful. I have my reservations about some of the things that happened in the film, which I'm sure we can jump in and talk about as we go on. But it's a film that stuck with me in some aspects. There is certainly a successful, eerie ambience to it. And I think that it's something that the director manages to get through. The dream sequence.
Oh,
sequence, yeah. That you mentioned. What a haunting, visually striking vision. It's probably I think that's when the film peaked. That part, I think, is probably the most notable part, other than Kirk Douglas' nudity. But
yes, yeah.
So people, if you don't want to see a 60-year-old man running naked, don't watch the film. But it's a very visually striking sequence, and it really stuck with me. And I used the image of the dragons, the dragon heads, and that for a couple of things when I was writing about the film. I used that image to sort of, this is what you're getting in. I think that they played there's this twist. Can we talk about spoilers?
We can. We don't shy away from spoilers on this show, but I think I know the one you're talking about. I would say let's save it a little bit we can kind of give folks a warning on it. But yeah.
Yeah. Kirk Douglas, which was one of my main drives, he's not top form here. He's competent, but I don't think he's in top form here. He's a bit hammy. Which it's kind of what the film is calling for, really, but it's not maybe what I was expecting. Also, that he has a romance with a woman in his 20s, he's in his 60s, and he starts his romance with this woman that's in her 20s, and it's a bit cringy, especially because it includes full nudity and sex scenes and whatnot. But the supporting cast was also solid. The guy that played the killer, Massimo Foschi.
He
stole pretty much all his scenes. He was pretty good.
He looks he reminded me of Terrence Stamp in Superman 2. You know, it looks like General Zod. When I first caught him, I was like, is that Zod? Oh, my!
I was thinking the exact same thing. Yeah. The film has a lot of pieces in its right place, and it walks that fine line between thriller, mystery, horror, and I kind of like that. I like the mystery aspect to it, the eerie ambience that I said that the film had. I thought the special effects in that dream sequence were pretty good, but the story is a bit muddled. Logistics of how the Antichrist will take control feels like a lot of random stuff. They play a lot with numerology, but not in a way that makes a lot of sense. It feels like more random numbers thrown together.
And yeah.
There are a lot of things that you feel like, for example, the Jesus thing that they then reveal that it's something that you can read in two ways.
Right. The backwards letters look like digital numbers. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like a bit like sloppy and a bit like borrowed. For example, The Shining had, Shining is older, but The Omen had a lot of stuff about the 666, so let's play with that. And the whole numerology thing felt a bit random to me.
I agree. It felt a little random, and it felt also like I was sitting there going, I don't know how much of this is actually biblical. You know, I mean, I know stuff, but I can't say I have the book of Revelation memorized. And so, you know, there's things that, you know, I was looking at and going, okay, I recognize that. I recognize that. And then there's other things that they would bring up and I was going, are you making that up for this movie? I don't think that is so really strange. Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're totally right. This is a movie where they're throwing a lot of things at you when it comes to all the biblical prophecy, the revelation stuff, and some of it works and some of it doesn't. And I think one of my bigger complaints about the film, and don't get me wrong, I was thoroughly entertained by it. I think what you said about how it works in some spots and other parts it doesn't is totally correct. It certainly had me engaged, but you know, one of my hang-ups with it was I thought the film got a little bit too bogged down in trying to explain itself when it comes to, you know, all this prophecy stuff. I think that, I mean, we're going to be talking about the comparisons to The Omen a lot. There's no way around it. I think The Omen, it's much more organic the way that they do that. I think in The Omen, they just kind of, they put some things out there and they don't feel the need to over-explain it to you. You know, you get it with a few simple things and you move on. And here I think the film feels like it has to go a little bit out of its way because it's going in some stranger directions than The Omen does, and they're trying to make sure you understand it all.
Yeah, and you have like this, the scientist that is investigating the computer. Then you have the professor that Kane wants him to back up the project, but then he disappears and then he looks for him. So there are like a lot of strands that they try to use to sort of give some credence to this, and I don't think they all fully work together. The whole numerology thing, like I said, they try to bring up, oh, you know, there's the number of security measures that the nuclear plant have will coincide with some weird numerology that again, we don't know if it's fully Bible based, but they're just random numbers that match. There's that scene where Kane starts to listen to a recording of how the plant works, and he starts remembering, oh, but there's this prophecy that says this and that, and he starts to like connect the dots about what is the connection. But it's just like random numbers. Right. It's just like, okay, 10 crowns, oh, 10 security systems, 10 heads and 10 towers, and it doesn't fully, it feels, again, random.
Well, and it's a little odd too that Kane is the one who is connecting the dots, because one of the things they establish early in the film, I mean, in the first scene before the credits even roll, this is where he meets the young woman who's eventually going to become his second wife. Yes. And, you know, he shows her this cave near the site where they're going to be building the power plant. And, you know, she sees the carving that says Jesus, and she takes his picture in there, which later on he sees the picture and there's this image of a dragon on the wall behind him when they see the developed picture and all that. But when they're in the cave, she says some things about, oh, this might be this cave that is prophesied about and this. And she seems to know all this stuff. And yet as we go through the film, she's not the one that's giving this information to him. He's connecting the dots through other things. He meets a priest on a plane and connects the dots that way. And it seems to me like it would have been more appropriate for this mysterious woman who has entered his life to you know, be the one to help him understand what might be happening here.
But I feel that even, I don't know to how, to what extent, but it feels that they either didn't know, that they didn't fully know what to do with the women, or were just playing the red herring thing wrong. Because there are moments where you feel, where they try to lead you into thinking that she's into something, but then they pull it back and they say, no, she's not. And there's this other thing. And it feels like that angle of that of the woman was a bit like half baked or not fully realized. And even the cave, the thing about the cave, they mention it and it's present in the pictures and in the vision. But I don't think they fully exploit that, like, for example, the importance of the cave or why this signals the arrival of the Antichrist, or how this serves to pave the way for the coming of the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When it comes to, you know, these parallels that we can draw between this film and The Omen, I guess, does it go too far with that? Because, I mean, all right, you know, it's a story about a guy who thinks his child is the Antichrist. Okay, simple enough. But there are several other beats in this movie that seem like they're right out of The Omen. I mean, for one, just the idea that it's a film where we have a classic era Hollywood star now further on in life, you know, at the lead of this satanic horror type film. You know, in The Omen, it's Gregory Peck. Here, it's Kirk Douglas. Just like in The Omen, he's an American living abroad. Of course, in The Omen, he's a politician. Here, he's the head of a corporation. I mean, both films even have a decapitation, which is kind of one of the most memorable moments of the film. I mean, does it go too far when it comes to, you know, the things where it's copying from The Omen?
There's even the moment where in The Omen they are driving to the church, and Damien, the kid, starts crying and
oh yeah.
And then you have here the moment, which is one of the moments that I was trying to bring up, the moment where he is trying to force his wife or girlfriend, I don't know if they get married, but the young woman to get into church, and she doesn't want. So there's that parallelism as well. There's the in The Omen, Gregory Peck is being assisted or held by a priest, and in here, there's, like I said, there's that the professor that then goes away into that village or that water island or whatever. And there's also the scientist that's working on the computer. So there are a lot of people that are helping both characters that eventually end up dead or disappearing. Mm-hmm. And obviously the final revelation of who is actually the Antichrist. But yeah.
We'll get there. Yeah. Well, and one thing I want to touch on too here is, you know, we mentioned that this film certainly has a lot of connection to the Italian giallos. And yeah. I think there's a lot of things that we can look at here where I think, like you said, it's not a pure giallo, I'd say, but there's certainly a lot of elements that as you watch it, you go, oh, well, clearly they're influenced by that style. In fact, just now, as you were talking about the scene with the wife and she doesn't want to go into the church, I mean, that segues into what is, I think, one of the most disturbing scenes of the whole film, and a major difference between this and The Omen. Of course, in The Omen, Damien is, you know, an actual kid and all that. And, you know, it's, the question is, do we kill the kid? Well, here the kid is unborn. So they tried to force her to have an abortion in one scene. And Kirk Douglas and the priest take her to this place and under the guise of it's just, you know, it's a routine examination and such. And then we have, you know, creepy doctor and nurse, and they're pulling out all these shiny, bizarre looking instruments and stuff. And as you're watching this, you're going, oh my goodness, look at this giallo stuff we're seeing here. You know, but that scene, just the way that it's setting things up, and she's looking all around the room and the camera's spinning as it looks at all these different instruments and stuff. You know, that's one of the most disturbing scenes of the film. And I think that film or that scene is purely rooted in giallo.
Yeah, I agree. And there's even the stabbing, the first stabbing with the Angel's mother and Kane's ex-wife or wife. It's very giallo, and how they show the stabbing, the blood, the way the camera moves. It's very, very much a giallo inspired. Even the beheading, although I was thinking also about Dawn of the Dead. But yeah, the beheading is feels very much taken from a giallo. But yeah, that scene, it felt weird, the abortion scene, because I was thinking what were the intentions here, if they were trying to push something forward at this time, 70s. But it felt weird, but it was disturbing indeed.
Well, yeah, we have to talk about the decapitation too, because I mean, as we kind of said, that's I think one of the most memorable moments of the film. It's very shocking. I mean, this is a film where it's got violent moments, but it's not just wall-to-wall violence. The violence comes in little spurts, I would say. But when it happens, it surprises you. I mean, the biggest moment before the decapitation is that scene you were just talking about where Kane's first wife is killed. And it's very, gets very bloody very quickly, and you know, again, very giallo, you know, it's a knife, a big knife, and bright red blood, and it's just you know, it more blood than you would think a wound like that would produce in half a second, you know. But then we get to this decapitation scene, and it's, you see it coming a mile away.
Yeah,
I mean, it's they're there on the airstrip. There's a helicopter. You see the wind pick up. The windsock starts blowing, and the way the camera frames the shot, we see this Middle Eastern president or whoever it is that's just been elected, and the helicopter is there in the foreground, and you can see the blade kind of tilting down because it's blowing in the wind and stuff, and you just know he's going to get hit with this thing. And yet when it happened, I jumped out of my seat because I was not expecting it to play out the way that it did. I think I was expecting it to be like when the mechanic gets hit by the propeller in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, it's like, you know, cut away in the blood spurt and that's that. Yeah. But that, I mean, we get impact here, and it is jarring.
It's you can see the top of the head blown away in full glory. Yeah, like you said, you can see it coming. They played pretty well how he's approaching, and you see the blade. He's turning back to say goodbye to everybody in the press conference. It's and the camera focuses on the pilot who's tilting the helicopter and has its hand on the controls, so you can really see it on my comment. But yeah, it still made me jump as well.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about our cast and all that, but before we do, we kind of hit on it earlier, but the dream sequence is the other sequence that I think really stands out. And when I look online about, you know, what people have to say about this movie, the few people that have seen it, the thing they always talk about in this sequence is that Kirk Douglas is 60 years old and running around naked in it. this is one of the just trippiest dream sequences I've seen in a while. And I got to say, it didn't come across as campy to me. It worked for me, as strange as it was. Sure, I was maybe a bit distracted by the fact that Kirk Douglas was running around naked. When I say that too, I mean, like, he's running towards the camera naked, folks. It's not just, you know, his backside. It's full frontal. And, again, it's kind of obvious imagery, you know, the power plant and, you know, transforms into this seven-headed dragon, which, again, I think the film wants to surprise us with that. But I mean, as an audience, we catch on to it much earlier in the movie than I think the filmmakers intend. It's, you know, very obvious when they start talking about seven-headed dragons in the Book of Revelation, and we see the model with seven towers and these balls on top of the towers. You know, okay, well, that's the dragon. All right, I get it. But still, when this dream sequence comes along And we have these shots that, you know, dissolve into this image of a dragon, which it's not like it's a puppet or anything like that. It's still, it's not animated, but still it's pretty effective.
Yeah, it's a very well constructed model. And it looks, I agree that it doesn't feel campy. Like I said, I think this is a moment where it really feels eerie and creepy. And this, I think, is when this really dark atmosphere peaks. I think it's a pretty successful sequence.
It did surprise me. I freeze framed on the dragon image, though, and if you just look at it, the dragons have these weird smiles on their faces, which I thought was kind of strange. And you know, there is a part of me that really wanted it to be animated.
That's in the reading.
I mean, I'm sitting there thinking, maybe you could have called up the guys at Toho and borrowed a couple of Ghidorah costumes and strung them together, and you got a seven-headed dragon, something like that. I mean, that would have been cool. I get it. It wasn't in the budget for AIP. It's still kind of cool here. So, yeah, that's fine with me. Well, let's talk more about the cast here. I mean, you mentioned Kirk Douglas. You said you're a big fan of Kirk Douglas. I mean, this is older Kirk Douglas here. This isn't Spartacus. This isn't Ace in the Hole. We're many years down the line, and sometimes I got the impression maybe Kirk was trying to prove something here. But I guess as a fan of his earlier films, I mean, how's this stand up, do you think?
I mentioned it before. He's definitely here, not in top form. He is competent. I don't think he's bad, but he's definitely... Some of his earlier films, like, for example, Out of the Past, Ace in the Hole, he's so natural and he's so laid back and confident. And here, he's confident here, but maybe more than he should. But but you can feel that he's a bit like chewing scenery here. He's, again, hamming it up in some sequences, not as natural or as laid back as I've seen him in other films, which is, even though I haven't seen it in a long time, I haven't seen Spartacus in quite a while, but I think in Spartacus he's good, but he's leading in that way. He's walking away from the more natural performance of the 40s and 50s and leading to a more hammy and again scenery shooing part of his acting life, maybe.
Yeah, I enjoyed what he gave. I think you're absolutely right. It does get a little hammy at times, especially as we get through the end, because as we're moving to the end, it's where he has the opportunity to do crazy. And don't get me wrong, Kirk Douglas is good at doing crazy, but it maybe goes a little too far in a few places. And it is weird. I mean, we kind of touched on it earlier, but there's these moments in the film where you're going, Kirk, you're not 33 years old anymore. You know, he's doing these scenes where he's running around naked. There's this fairly graphic love scene that he's got with a woman who is 33 years his junior. It almost feels a little like he's really trying to prove that he's still this young, virile screen idol type of guy, you know? And yeah, it's a little bit strange to watch, you know. Granted, the guy lived to be 103 years old, so yeah. Maybe he was still pretty young and virile this time. I don't know, but it does come off a little icky at times.
Yeah, it's cringy.
Now, we didn't really mention the young lady that plays his second wife. Her name is Augustina Belli. I hope I said that right. But what did you think of her performance?
She was good. I think that she got better towards the end. I think that in the end, when she's, for example, the scene that you mentioned, the abortion scene, or when she's in the hospital after giving birth, she really transmitted that desperation and not knowing what is going on, and I want to protect my baby. I think that she was more effective in that part. In the first parts, she was a bit more, obviously she has a very heavy Italian accent. Her line delivery is not that good, but I think she got better as the film as the film went on.
I agree with that. And I think part of that may be because she's given more to do in the second half of the film. You know, really, in the first part of the film, she's introduced and she doesn't really have a whole lot to do other than kind of gaze at Kirk Douglas. And, you know, it's not until we get into more, some of the bigger moments there as we're moving into the second half of the film, you know, into the big conclusion and such, that she really gets a chance to do some stuff. And I think she pulls it off pretty well. And then we got to talk about the creepy son, Angel, played by Simon Ward. I thought it's perfect that his name is Angel because he's one of those actors that just has this angelic looking face that you look at it and you go, all right, there's something not right here.
<You know? laughs> Doing the nose.
But I mean, I liked what he gave. You know, I think he certainly brings a certain level of mystery to things, which, I mean, we'll get to why here in a second. But yeah, I mean, it's a part that, you know, is supposed to bring a lot of question marks to the viewer. And I think he pulls that off pretty well.
Yeah, I agree. I think he did a fine job.
Well, let's go ahead and get to spoiler territory here. So I guess, folks, if you don't want to know the big twist on this one, you know, jump ahead a few minutes. But, you know, as we've kind of said, this film, as it goes on, we are believing that the unborn child of Cain and his new bride is the Antichrist about to be born. Okay. But we eventually learned that Cain actually has the wrong child in mind, which, if you didn't figure it out already, I mean, his adult son, Angel, is actually the Antichrist, already born. So that is why he's so determined to see through the construction of this power plant, because it's going to be the instrument through which he's going to bring about Armageddon. And in fact, it was kind of interesting because I went back and looked at a few things earlier in the film, and you can see where seeds are planted early in the film and seeing him kind of manipulating certain moments. You know, we talked about the scene where the first wife is stabbed. And if you watch that scene, you'll see that, you know, this guy comes after Cain and an Angel grabs him and is wrestling with him with the knife. And in the moment where the knife is driven into the stomach of his mother, he's the one actually guiding the hand there. So they do some sly things there that are pretty effective. But I guess, I mean, were you on to this early on? Was it much of a twist or is it obvious pretty early?
I went back and forth. I think at first I thought, yeah, you know, this is the Antichrist. But when the young woman gets pregnant, what's her name? I forgot her name. Sarah gets pregnant. I thought, you know, okay, well, I went with it. I took the bait. But at some point, even before they spelled it out, I remembered the story that they told about that Angel had a twin brother and that he apparently the other brother died stillbirth. Did they mention about the umbilical cord?
Yes.
Well. And I remember that I said, okay, no, but this is because they say that it will be the second son. But most people are thinking, you know, he already has Angel, that's the first son, and this unborn child is the second son. But actually, Angel is the second son. So I remembered that, and I thought, oh, okay, no, this is what's happening. But one of the things that I wanted to bring up, which I kind of hinted earlier, was the thing with the. It's one of the things that kept bothering me. If Sarah didn't have anything to think, like I told her, they were playing like a bit of a red herring with her, the unborn child. But if she had nothing to do with this, why did she make so much of a fuss to get in the church?
Right.
Because she pretty much threw herself in the ground. I don't want to get in the church. And you're thinking, oh, yes, because you're carrying the Antichrist and you know that and you don't want nothing to happen to your child. But if that's not the case, why all that struggle? So I felt it was like a bit of a red herring that didn't fully work for me.
And I've wondered if, you know, in different versions of this film, if she isn't, I guess, in on it, so to speak, you know, or a part of this whole plot. There are different endings of this film. And I guess I ultimately don't know what you saw. The only one that I know of that's streaming out there is the American ending, but I think both the European and the American ending are on the discs that were put out by Shout Factory. My understanding is the European ending, you know, basically has Kirk Douglas with the newborn child living in exile.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, they're leaving Angel to do his thing, and you know, Armageddon is going to happen eventually. From what I've read of synopsis of that, you don't see the wife as a part of that, or as being with Kirk Douglas. I don't know, I could be wrong, but
yeah, she was. I think she was with him.
Okay. I tried to find a copy of it where I could watch that ending, but couldn't find it. But the one that was in the version of the film that I watched, it feels a little tacked on. I've heard a lot of people refer to it as, well, they had to give the Americans a happy ending, which is basically where we have, you know, Angel is leading a board meeting and is moving forward with all his plans to build the power plant. And it seems like things are going to go his way. He thinks his father is dead and all that stuff. But then Kirk Douglas, you know, has some explosives and comes in and blows up the building, which it's actually put together in such a way that we actually don't see Kirk Douglas do that. We only see like his hands preparing dynamite, and then we see the door open, but we don't actually see him walk through, which makes me think, oh, they did this in reshoots when they didn't have Kirk Douglas anymore, you know, something like that. But I guess, does the ending work? Does the happy ending work, or did you want things to be where the world was going to end after all?
The one I saw was the one with where they're in exile. That's the one I saw. Then I read on the other ending, and I looked for it. It's on YouTube. So I saw the other one. I kind of like the one where they're in exile and things will happen. You can't stop evil, and it will happen anyway. But one of the things that I also wanted to mention is that I understand them holding on to the twist, who the antagonist is, who the bad son is. But it's a bit frustrating because it doesn't really allow for the Antichrist Angel to feel like a fully formed threat. He's not that threatening because he's always on that fence of, he's good, he's do I trust him? But they're keeping him for the twist. And I think they could have done a lot more with him as far as how threatening he can be and how high the stakes should feel.
I think you're right about that. I mean, if you put this guy in a room with Damien and said, who's going to win? I'd say Damien all the way.
Yeah, definitely. Damien probably kick him in the groin.
Well, we should start moving towards the break here. I want to give you a chance to give any final thoughts you have on this film. I want to throw out real quick, too. We didn't talk about the music. The music is by Ennio Morricone, so we can't let that go by. I mean, it's not one of his iconic works, but I mean, it's Morricone. So, I mean, that's worth something. And again, I would say there's maybe some influence of the Omen score on him in this, because you certainly have like the the haunting voices as a part of the score and things like that. But I don't care. Morricone can rip off the Omen score if he wants. I'm still gonna love it.
Yeah, I'm not much of a score guy, but when I saw that it was Morricone, I thought, oh, you know, this is important. Because of course I know of his work, and even though I don't think the score has any like distinct sequence, something that sticks out. I mean, if we're contrasting it with Ave Satani from The Omen, that is something that's a high mark. Mm-hmm. But I think the score is effective. It does the job. I think it's a pretty solid score.
Well, in general, before we go to the break, is this a film that, I guess you would recommend? Do you kind of say, well, maybe for the completists that want to see all the Satanic Panic movies of the 70s, I guess, where do you put this one?
When I rated it on Letterboxd, I rated it right down the middle, 2.5. I have reservations, which I've talked about, but I still think it is an interesting watch. I still think that it's something that even though you're not fully on board with everything that's happening, it's something that you can say, you know, I you said it in the beginning, I was entertained, even if not everything fully came on together. I enjoyed it. I think it could have used a better script. I think it could have used a stronger use of its apocalyptic stakes. What I mentioned about Angel, how they played that twist. But I like the, what I mentioned, the weird and eerie charm to it, the dream sequence. It's haunting. And I think there's enough on it to warrant a viewing. It certainly stuck with me.
I think I would agree with that. It's a film that doesn't entirely work, but it has its moments, and those moments are very memorable and are going to stick with you for a while. You know, there are other moments that get a bit, like I say, bogged down in the prophecy and all that stuff, and you know, where I think things could have been tightened up and it could have been worked a bit better. But you know, for those moments that are kind of the standout moments of this film, it's pretty entertaining, and I think it's certainly interesting to watch. Just thinking about the other films, the other Satanic Panic films, and especially The Omen. You know, I always find it intriguing to look at these movies that tried to capitalize on the success of an iconic film, especially horror films. And this is a trippy take on The Omen. So yeah, I enjoyed watching it.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another LAMB Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
What do Raiders of the Lost Ark and the Treasure of the Sierra Madre have in common? What about Goldfinger and the Spy Who Came in from the Cold? The Blues Brothers, and Silence. There's only one way to find out, and that is to listen to Howard Kasner and Pop Art, the podcast where we find the art in pop culture and the pop culture in art. For each episode, my guest chooses a movie from pop culture, and I'll choose a film from the more art indie classic foreign side of cinema that has a connection to it. So for those who want to know about Jurassic Park and Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and Son of Frankenstein, tune in to Pop Art on Apple iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and other streaming platforms near you.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to some bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of this show, which are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Jim Rex? What's Jim Rex? Would you believe a movie audience guide presented as a public service by this theater's management to help you select your motion picture entertainment? Well, that's what it is. And we urge you to learn these rating symbols and use them as a guide for you and your family. G means suggested for general audiences, all ages. M, suggested for mature audiences, parental discretion advised. R, restricted, persons under 16 not admitted unless accompanied by parent or adult guardian. X, persons under 16 will not be admitted. This seal in advertising indicates that the film was approved under the Motion Picture Code of Self-Regulation.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie that we've really enjoyed. Something we want everybody to check out for themselves. It might be a forgotten film. It might be an old classic. It might be something new that's in the theaters or on streaming services. It could be anything. So, Carlo, what is your recommendation?
Well, I'm going with a recommendation that I don't know if people are going to be able to find out, but I wanna recommend it because I thought there were some parallelisms with Holocaust 2000. And it was actually my first choice when we were trying to find a film to talk about. And it's Colossus, The Forbin Project. It's a film from 1970 that follows a scientist that designs and creates a computer, an advanced defense system that becomes sentient, which might lead to disastrous results in the country and in the world. And I wanted to mention it because I found so many parallelisms, because it also deals with someone, a man, that somehow creates an evil force. In the case of Holocaust 2000, it is an evil spiritual force. In the case of Colossus, it is an artificial force that threatens to take over the world. And it's one of those, I saw it a couple of years ago, and it's one of those high concept sci-fi films that sticks with you. It's smart, and I've been thinking about it ever since. I will say that it has a certain plot development that knocked it off the perch for me that I really didn't like. And it left a bad taste in my mouth. But despite that, it still stuck with me. And I've been thinking about it. And it's a film I recommend often. I know that when I brought it to you, you said this one isn't available. And yeah, I confirmed it then. It isn't available in any streaming service. So it's going to be hard for people to track it down. But if you can find it, Colossus, the foreign project from 1970, I think it's very much worth your time.
Yeah, this is one that I've heard folks talk about a lot, and I've never been able to catch up with it. It's just one of those that keeps eluding me, and always been having a hard time trying to nail down a copy of it. So I definitely want to check it out. So you've just made me even more intrigued to check it out. So. Well, the movie that I'm going to recommend, like you were doing there, I was trying to find something that would tie in with the movie we discussed. And so I was thinking about another film that deals a bit with the end of the world, though the film I settled on is not a biblical end of the world type scenario, but this is one where a cosmic event turns most of humanity into zombies. And so I got to bring up, this is from my favorite movie year of all time, 1984. I'm going to recommend Year of the Comet, which okay. is just a great 80s cult film. I mean, it wasn't a big success when it came out. 84 is such a big year. So many big hit, iconic movies of the 80s came out in that year. So there's a lot of ones that got a little bit lost and, you know, have been discovered years later. And Night of the Comet is certainly one of those. It focuses on two Valley girls in LA, and, you know, there's a comet that's going to pass past the Earth, and people are having comet parties and things like that. But the comet ends up turning people into zombies. And the girls, though, they stay safe because they are in the projection room of the movie theater where one of them works. And I guess that's shielded in some way or something. It's the power of movies that keeps them safe, I guess. But the girls are played by Catherine Mary Stewart and Kelly Maroney. And both are just fantastic in this film. I love the way that they respond to this strange situation. And, you know, even though it's outlandish, the way they behave is actually very believable. I mean, you know, everybody gets wiped out or they turned into zombies or whatever. So what do these two do? Well, they go to the mall and they have a shopping spree when they don't have to pay for anything and all that. And I'm thinking, that makes sense to me, you know. And then as that scene comes to an end, they're attacked by a bunch of zombie stock boys, which that scene has always stuck with me because I was a stock boy back when I was in high school in the 80s. So, you know, I've always kind of loved that sequence. But it's a pretty lighthearted film. I mean, it's got funny moments, but a lot of the film is actually played pretty straight. You know, it's just got a sense of humor to it. And it is just 80s through and through. I mean, the look of it, things, the music, just the whole feel is just quintessential 80s. So, yeah, definitely a cult favorite from my favorite movie year, Night of the Comet. If you haven't checked it out, definitely worth a watch.
Yeah, one of the things that it's always very striking, and I think it's one of the things that is more seen on the images of the film is the cinematography and the color, the orange colored sky. And, it's one of the things that is highlighted with a reason. It looks really good.
Well, Carlo, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and your show.
They can find The Movie Loot on every podcasting platform, streaming platform, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. And they can find me on Twitter. There's a podcast account that it's TMML2021. And there's my personal account where I like to engage with like-minded people, movie lovers. And it's Thief CGT, T-H-I-E-F CGT. You can find me, you can talk with me, engage with me, find the show, listen to it, let me know what you think, give me recommendations, whatever you want.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, folks, that does it for this episode of the show. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read other reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so feel free to email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, go watch some old movies. We'll see you again real soon.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.